Welcome to our Friday Five Live podcast hosted by Meg Foster. Meg has spent 20 years in higher education focused on student success initiatives and working in areas such as orientation, faculty development, online learning, student leadership, and first-year initiatives.
Well, welcome everyone. Happy Friday. Welcome to our August Friday Five Live. We appreciate you joining us and so thrilled to have Kate Denial with us today to talk about her new book. And she might be available to come to a campus or maybe heading to a campus near you this semester. It sounds like she's going to be traveling all over. Just a couple of quick housekeeping reminders. If you are joining us and you're a GoTo Knowledge member, this will be available on your dashboard. Otherwise, early next week, you will receive a recording from our conversation today. Also, a fun reminder that this is a podcast, and so it's available on all of our all podcasting networks, and I think we pair nicely with a cup of tea or a walk around campus, so feel free to share this with faculty and staff who maybe couldn't be with us today. Love to see many of you hopping in the chat. Let us know where you're listening from. Please do put questions in the chat for Kate. As always, I've prepared some questions, but I'm sure you guys have much better ones than me. So put those in the chat and we'll make sure that we weave those into our conversation. So welcome. We've got Anna joining us and Melanie from Cincinnati. We are just delighted that you're here with us today. And Kate, thank you for joining us as we get the chance to talk about the idea of compassion and kindness in our teaching and learning. So again, just some ways that you can share with us, with your colleagues, but we are thrilled that Kate was kind enough to say yes to my invitation to come and share her good work with us today. So as you can see, it's such a fun picture of you. Kate Denial is the Bright Distinguished Professor of American History and the Director of the Bright Institute at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois. Kate is taking the semester to travel, supporting her latest book, and we'll make sure that we put that link, if you're just joining us, in the chat again for you. It's called A Pedagogy of Kindness. And that's really what propelled me forward to say to Kate, we need more of this. And I need to learn from her too. So I'll also put the slides in as well for us. As you can tell, Kate just has extensive experience, not only in the United States, but internationally, really helping folks like ourselves provide the best kind of possible teaching and learning opportunities for our students. So Kate, thank you so much for spending some of your Friday with us.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
And we understand the weather in Kate's neck of the woods is not too bad too. So that is wonderful. All right, well, let's get to our questions. So just to really kick us off, your book, A Pedagogy of Kindness, how did this come to be? Like what made you say, this needs to get written, this needs to be shared, and here's how I kind of came to this framework?
So the key thing was that I went to the Digital Pedagogy Lab in 2017. That was in Fredericksburg, Virginia at the time. And I was so impressed by everybody's kindness at the Institute. They were so thoughtful, from, you know, pronoun pins at the check-in desk to the food we had sustained us. Sometimes, you know, you go to a conference or something and it's limp little sandwiches for lunch and you're like, this isn't going to get me through an afternoon. But everything was so thoughtful. And so I also was part of an intro track where they had us think critically about absolutely everything to do with our teaching. Mm-hmm. And at the time that I went, I was pretty proud of what kind of a teacher I was. I had been teaching since 1994, and there was definitely a big learning curve for me in what kind of teacher I wanted to be. But by 2017, I was like, I got this. And then they had us actually come in and start looking at the language we used in our syllabus and thinking about the way that we asked students to do assignments. And I realized, oh my gosh, I'm actually not doing this the way that I want to. My values and my goals are not at all reflected in what I do. So I came away from that thinking a lot about what I wanted to change. And one of the ways that I always think things through is by writing. So I do a lot of journaling and things like that. I have a blog. I do some things there. I wrote some things about it there. But then I really wanted to seize hold of this idea of kindness and how transformational that could be. Mm-hmm. So I wrote an article about it for Hybrid Pedagogy. That was published in 2019. And then my colleague, Josh Eiler, who is at the University of Mississippi, said, it needs to be a book. This needs a longer treatment. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay, I'll try it. And approached the same publishing company that had published Josh's book and got tremendous support along the way. We changed publishers halfway. That was a whole thing. But I have had the most tremendous support from editors and friends and mentors and colleagues. So once I made the decision that like this is something worth exploring in more depth, then it was really just it was really fun to write.
That's amazing. I love that, you know, you came to this place where you were like, all right, well, I've been doing this work of teaching. And I think we often laugh in higher education. I think I taught for 15 years before anybody actually taught me how to teach.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And I think we're catching up a lot. I think there is a lot of really important work being done, I'm sure, by many of you around, teaching and learning and how we can help faculty to continue to improve in those areas. And so, but how, I don't know, it's just really neat to hear of an experience where you go and you think, well, I think I've got some confidence in this area, right? I can teach. And then being so open to, oh, there are these other ways of conceptualizing this and approaching this that I hadn't right. really thought about before.
Exactly.
And how powerful. I'm reminded that at the start of each semester, I kind of have to remind myself that, I mean, I am a nerd. Like, I love to learn. But I teach a lot of people who do not feel that way about the learning process. And so I kind of have to do a little mental reset. Okay, you know, I'm not teaching a class of 25 Megs, you know, I'm teaching a broad array of students who come at this place from lots of different perspectives. So, and that might be a way to kind of come to this next question about, you know, when we think about, and maybe we could define first, like what are kind of, when you say pedagogy of kindness, and I've been fortunate enough to get a peek at the book, sort of what are the platforms or the pillars of that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So kindness, I always start by saying what it's not, and it's not being nice. So niceness, I think the defining quality of being nice to people is often that you will lie to them, because nice will do anything to get along. It doesn't like conflict. It would prefer that we not ask hard questions about concepts like rigor or power, right? And so we often, our institutions are really fueled by niceness, where it appears that we're all getting along just fine. But if you dig even a little bit, there are all kinds of things going unaddressed. Kindness, I say, is honest. Kindness actually wants to have those difficult conversations. And the three pillars of a pedagogy of kindness are, first of all, attention to justice. Mm-hmm. Second of all, believing students. And third, believing in students. So believing in their capacity to be the co-creators of their educational experience. The justice part of things is really about taking the time to really appreciate both our own positionality and that of our students, and to understand the many different places that they're coming from in terms of money and class and race, gender, sexuality, religion, all kinds of things. It's about thinking about the fact that many of our students are housing insecure and food insecure. It's about thinking about the number of students who have disabilities but can't afford the testing and the time that it takes to get accommodations. Mm-hmm. And thinking about, like, okay, if this is our situation, if this is our student body, how do then we react to that in the way that we build all of our policies, our documents, our classroom activities, our homework, everything around an appreciation for what's going on in their lives.
So justice, believing in our students, and believing students.
Yeah.
And peel back a little, if you don't mind, the believing in students. That's an interesting approach, I think.
I think that many of us are taught to think of our students as antagonists. Certainly that's how I was trained as a graduate student. Suspect them at all times. They're going to cheat. They're going to plagiarize. They're going to want a grade changed. You know, all of these, this litany of complaints, really. And I don't think that's actually true of the vast majority of people that we are teaching. So it's about believing in them and their capacity to really take hold of their own education and be able to shape it alongside me, right? I have some experiences and some expertise that they don't yet have, but they are the experts on how they're learning and even why they're not learning, right? And so asking them to be participants in the process of the class in thinking about, is the homework going to be X or Y? Are we going to read this many things? Are we going to watch this particular movie at home, or are we going to do it in a screening? Are we going to giving them choices in their assignments? All kinds of different things, but really allowing them choice and agency and flexibility.
I'm taking notes because I always do, because that's the kind of student I am. And I'm you know, really struck by that idea. I mean, we talk about this so much. I mean, I was just, you know, on campus this week and, oh, AI, right? I mean, I think there is, it feels like the suspicion of students, unfortunately, feels like it's getting stronger, or instead of approaching it from, and all that you're saying just reminds me of, you know, I'm not an expert, but what I've learned about how we teach in particular adult learners, right? Mm-hmm. That they, that agency is very important to them in their growth and learning. And so, which I think it's important that we're grounded in that as more and more adult students come back into our classrooms, which is exciting.
Yeah, agreed.
So okay. So we kind of have this base of what it is to be kind. And I think always important to differentiate from nice. And there's a lot of really good work out there around what that means in institutions that are able to speak to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I know that's a challenging space for a lot of our schools to be in at this place. But what are some practical strategies? So I'm day one, right? And I'm excited about Kate's work. This is the semester. We're going to take kindness as the theme. I'm just, you know, getting pumped up here. What are some things that we can do in that classroom? Or in our, I'm even thinking in our offices, right? If you're a staff person, staying in and you're doing academic advising, or you're a TRIO advisor, to really kind of enfold this sort of these pillars into our work.
So let me start with the office one. I learned from experience that one of the things that's hardest to do as someone working in an office space when a student walks in is to pause what you're doing, right? I used to do a lot of, let me just finish this sentence. I just got to send this email, right? And then I went into a colleague's office and they did that to me and said, hang on, I just got to finish the sentence. And I experienced that as a little punch. I was like, I'm here because of something important, right? And it wasn't a sense of my importance. It was just a sense of, oh my gosh, this is what I do to my students all the time. I don't just actually turn to them and say, hey, how are you, right? And it's as simple as that, right? Taking the time to actually greet them and look them in the eye, or to make some kind of connection that's appropriate, right? That is, I think, one of those very small but very transformational things. So always pausing, always turning around, always saying, hello, how are you, right? The same is true of classrooms, right? Walking in and saying hello. I have a lot of colleagues who are really good at going into a classroom before class begins and chatting with students and just sort of warming everybody up. I am terrible at that. I am so bad at it. I'm such an introvert that sort of walking in cold and trying to make conversation is really hard for me. But I go in as soon as it's time and I have a big hello for everybody. And that is much easier for me, right? On that first day, often one of the first things that we do is give students a syllabus. Mm-hmm. And those syllabi are often giant walls of text. They look intimidating. They are intimidating to, especially if people have reading comprehension difficulties, ADHD, there's a lot of information to try and parse and it's not in a user-friendly format. So one of the things that I do is I've changed the design of my syllabi completely so that there's always a really cheerful header. Some of them are just photographs that I found from free websites. Some of them are headers that have actually been designed, right? But something colorful, something welcoming, something that says, hey, this is going to be fun, right? And then I say, hi, I'm Kate Denial. I'll be your professor this term. And this is how you can reach me. That's always the first thing on my syllabus. So I've made the tone of my syllabus much more conversational. I have broken up all those big chunks of text by having little icons down the side of the page that give people cues for here's a new thing to look at. I have gone deep into thinking about accessibility. So where it used to just be bolded headings that work if you're sighted, but not if you aren't. I've now coded everything to be a header so that someone using a screen reader can actually read it. All of my icons, all of my images have alt text embedded in them. But the language choices are really where I've made the most changes, where this was very much something I got out of Digital Pedagogy Lab. Was looking at the way that we sort of tend to slip into an authoritarian voice when we're writing those syllabi. And we tend to think of those documents almost like they're legalistic. This is what you have to do. And if you don't do it, here are going to be the consequences, which is not the greatest way to introduce yourself to someone, right? So I've changed the language to be warmer, to be about the things we are going to do rather than you are going to do. And to make sure that when I don't use words like plagiarism anymore. I use plain language definitions of those kinds of terms so that students really know where they stand, right? So all of that is part of that being welcoming, making things open, making sure that students find it accessible to be in that classroom, whether we're talking about disability or just nerves, right?
Mm-hmm. As they so are. I mean, we're all nervous on those first days. And I know for some of us, we may be at institutions where there's less flexibility with the syllabus design. But I've seen some colleagues who've done some clever things with even just having a cover page, right? That's kind
of. Or some places have like a student facing document that they give out in addition to the very policy heavy document that they give out. I think something everyone can do, no matter how much freedom they have to determine what goes on their syllabus, is have students annotate the syllabus. Because then you give students a chance to talk back to all of that language, right? To ask questions of it, to say what's confusing, to be able to say, oh no, I really like this policy sometimes, right? And I find that that means that students read the whole syllabus. They learn a valuable tool if they don't already know what annotation is. And then we can have a conversation about the things that they found confusing. I know where they need clarification. It's just a really good opening activity.
Mm-hmm. And as you dive further into the semester, how is this approach? You know, you mentioned before we hit the record button, it sounds like that you're using a very different kind of grading.
Yeah.
Approach in your class. And curious about how that ties in, right, to this approach, this pedagogy.
So one of the things that came up at Digital Pedagogy Lab was the effect of grades on student motivation, on students' ideas of self-worth, and the fact that in many ways, grades are kind of arbitrary, right? We all know what they signify to us in our courses, but there's very little sense of, well, an A in biology is the same as an A in English literature, right? So out of those conversations, I started to follow a movement called ungrading. Mm-hmm. And I started very, very small. I still had grades for a very long time, but I brought my students into the conversation about what grades should be. So they would write a paper and they would come to me for a little 10-minute meeting. They would fill out a self-evaluation before they arrived about the work they had done. And that was the basis of our conversation that ultimately ended up in us agreeing on what their grade was going to be. Mm-hmm. I'm now at a point where I don't grade. I give my students lots and lots and lots of feedback in many different modalities. But the grading that I have to do at the end of the term, where I have to turn in a letter or a number for the purposes of GPA and everything, that is something my students decide, and their last paper is a reflective paper where they reflect on their learning. So they're doing some really important metacognitive work. Mm-hmm. And then they tell me what grade they think they have earned in the class. This is preceded by us talking about what grades mean to them, what they meant in high school very often, where they've had bad experiences with grades, where they've had good ones, how it is and isn't tied to self-worth. So they're grading themselves from a very different point than they would have right at the beginning of the term, right? And then I reserve the right to alter that grade if I think they're being really hard on themselves, because there's a real equity issue in that students who are women, non-binary, trans, students of color tend to grade themselves lower than white male students do, for example. And so I want to be attentive to where I think those equity issues are playing out. And so I might say to someone, hey, I think you're being really hard on yourself. It's not a C. I think we should absolutely put you in here as a B. What do you think of that? And we have a continued conversation.
Have you seen any changes? Like, right, kind of what has been the outcome of this sort of shift in how you're grading in your classes? I'm so curious about this.
The motivation has changed completely. So alongside this has come a lot of work and a lot of planning around giving students choices about their assignments and the subjects that they pursue so that they're really motivated to learn because it's something they've chosen that they're really interested in. And so I just find that students are doing work more consistently. They are asking better questions. They are just more committed to the enterprise of learning as separate from earning a letter or a number.
Mm-hmm. It's so exciting. It's got to be to watch students. Because, I mean, I'm going to share my bias, Kate. I was a history major, right? I mean, I think the work you're doing is incredibly important. And I know a lot of students are like, oh, I don't want to take a history class, right? Like,
yeah,
right. History is not, people are like, oh, majored in history? Like, whoa, why would you ever do that? And so to hear you talk about students really coming to this place of metacognitive development, critical thinking skills, embracing the experience of learning, right?
Yeah.
Becoming scholars.
Yeah.
That's really exciting.
It's super exciting. And I'll tell you, the other bonus is that it is way more fulfilling to offer lots of different types of feedback on a regular basis than it is to grade things.
Mm. Right. The dreaded Scantron machine sound.
Exactly.
Yeah. So stressful.
Yeah.
Well, and I think this next question, I'm you know, thinking about the experience of having taught in different kinds of institutions, my own kids, we're often in competitive academic landscapes, right? Whether that's right or wrong. I think a lot of academic competition is a race to absolutely nowhere, and I do not understand it. But how do you kind of navigate, how have you shared this concept, you know, at your institution with other people trying to kind of break down that sort of space of competition? And I mean, I think about, you know, the work you did in graduate school. I mean, you know, graduate programs are kind of notoriously sort of competitive academic spaces. And,
yeah, I think we are socialized into competition as being part of academia, right? Whether it is the archetype of the professor alone in a lab or in an office pursuing pure research, held up as the most valuable forum of academic anything, right? That instills competition in us because we're always trying to get closer to that ideal, very often, whether or not we have consciously thought about it or not, right? It's just in it's the soup we're swimming in. We are encouraged to be competitors for fellowships, for places in different schools, for places in graduate programs, for jobs. And goodness knows the competition for jobs is so acute right now, right? All of these things, I think, add up to sort of a general suspicion of one another, as well as of our students. And so I think there's a lot of work for us to do to be able to sort of step outside of that paradigm and say, like, what am I competing for here? And are there other ways to move myself closer to goals that I have, to desired outcomes, without just sort of capitulating to the cultural soup of academia, right? Certainly, I have experienced a lot of competition, especially when I was in graduate school, and it was just the kind of thing that destroys people, right? It's not something that builds people up. It's not something that mentors people. It's not something that strengthens them. And so I try to bear that in mind with my students. In thinking about my own campus, I mean, much of what I know about teaching is stuff that I have learned from my colleagues, right? So at the beginning of every presentation I give, I have a list of my colleagues and I thank them by name. And the only reason I'm not doing that now is that I'm afraid that I will forget someone and then I'll hear about it, right? But there are tremendous colleagues who have been working on parts of this who I've learned an enormous amount from. My college is not... we do have elements of competition for sure. And there are elements where people feel very much in conflict with one another around compensation, around service, all kinds of things. They're very typical things that you find in academia, right? But I also do think it's a college where people really are in it for the right reasons and are sort of pulling for the same end for our students. And that's really satisfying about it as a place to work.
And you bring up such a good point. You know, we've had a lot of discussions on past podcasts about how do we create campuses where it's a culture of caring. Yeah. You know, there's been much discussion about, are you a student focused campus?
Yes.
But I think if we and we've talked about like trauma-informed care and how understanding that can really transform campus culture too. But if we kind of wed all of that together, I feel like with your work, it could be really transformative to institutions. And it sounds like, you know, you're at a fantastic place, which kind of is already doing this work. And I was really inspired being back on campus this week at how committed the people that I get to work with are to the success of students, to really understanding who we are teaching and how we can get them to that next place in their educational journey for their own success and the success of their families. I mean, because the ripple effect, of course, as we know, is so big.
Yeah. I was part of a grant from the Mellon Foundation for a project called Care in the Academy. And that project lasted from July of 2022 to December of 2023. And there were 36 of us involved, and we were from every kind of institution, from community colleges through regional publics, small liberal arts colleges, big flagship universities, and we were faculty and staff. And we investigated what would it look like to be trauma-informed in the way that we teach, that we not teach, but that we interact with our employees? Mm. What would it look like if we took disability really seriously? And what would it look like if we thought about pedagogy as something that needed to be sustainable for the people practicing it? So we produced a report that's available online. You can Google Care in the Academy and it'll take you right to our Substack where you can read what we concluded. And we are really looking forward to taking that work forward, especially in thinking about making our campuses actually accessible and welcoming. In fact, we want to go beyond accessibility, right? We want to make it a place where disability is understood and people are prized no matter what their abilities are. And that we have, we've thought about inclusion in a really dynamic way. So this is all stuff that's still ahead, but I couldn't agree more that we did a lot of work, I think, in the height of the pandemic to be very, very student focused and to ask, you know, what do they need right now? And I think it's equally as important that we talk about that for the people working at the institution.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think we've seen so much, I mean, very understandable burnout from people who have just poured themselves in. And we've talked, our podcast, strangely enough, kicked off, I think, month one, right, of pandemic. And so we've definitely talked about how do we continue to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves in ways that we can provide that support for the students that we're working with.
Right.
I want to make sure folks, you know, put your questions in the chat for Kate, and we'll make sure that we weave those into our conversation. You know, as so you've talked about care in the academy, any other things that you would say to us, this question about research and evidence, is there anything that you're like, all right, well, I would really encourage you to go make sure you have read or familiarized yourself with
I would say the footnotes to my book are a treasure trove of people who are so, so good at thinking about these questions. And I wish I could just tilt my computer screen so you could see the big bookcase beside me that is just filled with work by other people, right? I think that the Teaching and Learning series from West Virginia University Press was just an incredible resource for everyone. And now there is the Teaching, Engaging, and Thriving in Higher Education series at the University of Oklahoma, which is where I published my book. These series are just doing dynamic work in thinking holistically about teaching and learning. And there's everything from thinking about inclusivity in the most thorough ways that you can, to learning how we learn as human beings, to thinking about the ways in which things like anxiety manifest in us and in our students, in thinking about issues of basic justice on our campuses and what needs to change so that all of our students feel really welcome. So I would direct people to those two series, because then there's a just a vast array of different books and everyone will find something that will really zing for them.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And you know, I think an important reminder too, that yes, while we talk about this as teaching and learning, and certainly, you know, we go to college because of the classes, right? Like that's why we're there. That so much of this also applies to the work being done in all of those other spaces, right?
Yeah.
If as an advisor, if I have an understanding about how learning works, that really changes the conversation I'm having with my students. If I'm, you know, the wonderful people in our TRIO programs are doing lots of professional development around understanding inclusion and understanding accessibility and in a very holistic, nuanced kind of way. So, I think for so long, you know, I mean, we've always talked about the silos, and I really love the beauty of your work. I think one of the things is that it's bridging all of that space and reminding people it's not just about what happens in the classroom. It's about,
right.
Yeah. And I would also, I want to give a shout out to Kate's book, and but also your website is chock full of really great, your kind of blog, you know, some tips on how to start off class with that first semester, this beginning of the semester, right? And
right.
Yeah, really great information there. I've dug through and gleaned some
The best tip I've ever given anyone is that if you write on a board with a Sharpie, a whiteboard with a Sharpie, you can then write over that with a erasable pen and the whole thing will come off.
Seriously.
Seriously, right? This blows people's minds. And I don't remember who told me this. Somebody else told me this some time ago. But it is one of the most useful pieces of teaching advice I've ever received.
I mean, I'm going to confess right now, and we're recording this, one of the most embarrassing conversations I ever had was having to go to housekeeping and saying, oh my word, I wrote
I used a
every
Sharpie.
note on this huge dry erase board, whiteboard with a Sharpie, and I don't know what to do. And they were so sweet. And they were like, don't worry, boo, we got you. We take care of it. But I was just mortified. I was confident my entire paycheck was going to a brand new whiteboard. So
And it's super simple. So also hand sanitizer, if you're still carrying hand sanitizer, that will also work just as long as you got something to wipe it up with. Yeah.
Right. With your pack of Kleenex that we all
yes,
carry with
exactly.
us wherever we go, right?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll put the what we should all carry with us into that classroom. Well, I want to get to our last question and then make sure we've got space for others, but so, you know, you're spending this semester getting to go talk to all kinds of people all over the United States, maybe outside of the United States too, I don't know. And how fortunate are they? If we think about, and this is kind of that work, you know, that you mentioned also with CARE in the Academy, if you could gaze into the crystal ball, what's going to be the long-term impact of the shift in, if we could all put our time into doing this good work that you're doing?
All I can do is extrapolate from the difference that it has made for me. Mm-hmm. And I am less stressed. Mm-hmm. I am less nervous. I don't get the jitters before a new class starts because I no longer am walking into what I think is going to be combat. Right. Yeah. I'm walking into a space where we're going to be working together. And I'm really looking forward to that. So the jitters are gone. I have more time for the things that got me into teaching in the first place. Right. Really spending time with my students and less time spent on things that I found honestly hateful, like grading. Right. Writing things on papers was never my favorite thing. And so I became one of those professors who put it off and put it off and put it off. And then the students are like, where is our work? And I'm like, yeah, I know, I'll get to it, right? So it was a terrible learning environment for all of us, right? And I also think that there's just a certain peacefulness that mm-hmm. comes from knowing what I will revert to in every situation. So it's not that I have reached some kind of nirvana. It's not that I reached some kind of mountaintop and now I'm enlightened. That's not it at all. I get as angry and frustrated and tired as anybody. But it is now my habit to go, what is the kind thing to do here? Mm-hmm. And that just is such a refreshing change from sort of the scattershot thoughts of panic that I often had when I was in a difficult situation before, or where I got a really thorny problem I had to solve. Mm-hmm. So just asking myself, what is the kind thing to do here, has given me so much more peacefulness and freedom. Mm-hmm. And so I would love for everybody to have access to that, right? And I think that if we could make that the default in all our interactions, that would be amazing. I was at a college last week where one of the associate deans said, I need to think about the language I'm using in the beginning of semester emails I'm sending to faculty. So the stuff about the syllabus didn't apply, but the same principles of like thinking of people as antagonists applied to the sort of messages that we often get at the beginning of term, right? And so, and I was like, that's an amazing application. Yes, do that, right? So I think everything big and small could just get easier for us if we could do this.
Right. Because I hadn't even really extrapolated the idea that unfortunately, sometimes we do see one another. We approach, and I am just as guilty. I worked in a center for teaching and learning, and there were oftentimes I would go into faculty meetings and just, you know, your shoulders are up around your ears because you're already anticipating.
Yeah.
It's going to be that antagonistic kind of environment. And so
yeah,
approached it differently, not with niceness, with kindness.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How would that conversation have been different? How might it have been better received? Right.
Yeah.
That we're all working together with a common set of goals.
Mm-hmm.
A good reminder as we think about the start of this term, that this kindness applies to all of our team, right? The
students, right.
Our colleagues, all those folks we work with. Well, Kate, this has just been, I think, just the best way to start off a new term. Because it is, it's exciting and it's anxiety ridden. And I know that a lot of us are at institutions where there are not enough people doing the work, right?
Yeah.
We're being pulled in 11 million directions. I also know it's fall 2024 is going to be an interesting semester, I think, with the election and continued student protests from the spring semester. And it all feels very weighty at times. And
so
to be able to take that deep breath and kind of remind yourself about the kindness to one another, the kindness to self.
And there's a whole section of the book that is just about kindness to the self as a prerequisite for everything else.
Well, I hope everyone will hop in. I'm going to remind folks, Kate's book, a fantastic website. Just Google Kate Denial and you'll find her great website, which has lots of terrific information too, and just kind of inspiring as we start off this work together. And thanks to the many of you who've joined us today. We always do have kind of a final survey. It's helpful to me to make sure that we're shaping content. We've had just a really great summer of conversations around everything from how do we serve students who are basic needs insecure, to how do we teach classes in a 7-week format, thinking about that, conceptualizing that very differently, and which is fascinating. And next month, we're going to take a look at kind of the last 20 years in higher ed and what have been the changes, where have we been, where are we moving forward? So I think that'll be kind of a fun conversation to kick off the fall with. But Kate, thank you. I wish you all the best as you travel the United States this fall semester and spread this good, important work that you're doing. We are really, really fortunate that you're doing this work and spending time with us today. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me and thank you for such a lovely conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, great. Well, everyone take care. Have a good weekend. If you're starting class or if you've already started class, I just always wish everyone a weekend of some rest and some renewal. You know, I hope there's an opportunity to take a deep breath or go for a good walk and take care of yourselves. So thanks, everybody. We'll see you next month.
Friday Five Live is brought to you by Innovative Educators. Innovative Educators offers 6 online services for your onboarding support and training needs. Visit us at innovativeeducators.org to see how we can support your student success initiatives.